slept too little and drank too much.
What's diagnosis anyway? Get out of bed like this. Oh, Christ.
Rise and shine with CKUT 90.3 FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Good day. This is Free City Radio. It is Tuesday, the 21st of September, 2021, of course. Thanks for being with us. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph, in Montreal. This is the 60th edition of our weekly podcast. So thanks for being with us week in and week out. Every week I make an effort to bring a voice that I think is doing insightful, interesting, important work, both here locally in Geauguagé, Montreal, and sometimes internationally. Today is going to be a conversation with Bob Jeffcott of the Maquila Solidarity Network. That's an organization that for a couple of decades has worked to draw attention to the working conditions, the labor conditions of garment sector workers. It's an organization that started in the context of drawing solidarities with the Maquila workers in Mexico. This was in the context of the efforts to critique the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was being negotiated in the 1990s and was a point of protest for environmental and labor organizations who were highlighting the fact that trade agreements such as NAFTA really were about the commodification of the environment, labor, and our economy. And that is a critique that extends across numerous trade agreements. The Maquila Solidarity Network built support between Maquila workers and organizations representing workers in Mexico and labor unions both in Canada and the U.S. Their work now is more international. They've been pushing to highlight the condition of garment sector workers across the world, from Bangladesh to Vietnam and recently in Ethiopia. I think their work's important. I wanted to highlight where they're at, and I'll just leave it at that. This is my conversation with Bob Jeffcott from the Maquila Solidarity Network.
Yeah, well, I'm Bob Jeffcott, and I'm one of the founders of the Maquila Solidarity Network. So that goes way back. We started almost, over 25 years ago. And at the very beginning, we were focused on the reason we had the name Maquila Solidarity Network was we were focused on the Maquiladora factories along the border with Mexico and Canada. And that was at the period of negotiations of the original tri-national free trade agreement, NAFTA. So we were concerned at that time that the focus was on this idea that Mexicans were stealing our jobs. And we had a different perspective. We were trying to promote solidarity with the Mexican workers and supporting their struggles to improve their standards as well as their wages. So that's how it started. But 1 year later, we got involved in our first campaign that wasn't about Mexico. It was actually about firings of workers who were trying to organize a union in El Salvador. And we were lobbying the GAP at that time to ensure that the workers who were fired were reinstated. And in that period, companies would respond by saying, well, we don't own the factory. It's not our responsibility. So I think the struggle over the years has been, on the first hand, to get companies to acknowledge that they actually do share responsibility. The major brands do share responsibility, what happens to the workers who make their products. So that's basically the history. And, you know, in more recent years, we've been involved in campaigns such as about the Bangladesh Accord on fire and building safety. That was about something bigger than just people being fired in one factory.
Okay, well, there's a lot to unpack there. So I think there's three main points. So I'll just say, first of all, from your perspective, I mean, obviously there is a very important notion that is central to the US labor movement, which is solidarity. Mm-hmm. I just was wondering if you could just briefly talk about, because I know that within the US labor movement, there has been, you know, different elements that have been really open to and supported this idea of thinking about labor across borders, whereas some elements have been more protectionist. So yeah. I'm just wondering, like, an organization like yours really encourages a sort of a framework of understanding solidarity between workers across borders. Can you talk about the importance of that idea and how that relates to the US labor movement?
Well, I could talk also about the Canadian labor movement, because we're centered in, yeah. in Canada. But I think what's happened over the years is there has been a growing sense among unions, both in the United States and Canada, as well as in Europe, that they need to build common cause with workers and their struggles in other countries, particularly in globalized industries. And by that, I mean ones like the garment sector, one in which you have workers who are producing for local manufacturers oftentimes, or even for foreign investors, but they're producing for brands and retailers in the North American and European market. So a traditional strategy of just saying we're going to try to keep the jobs in Canada or the United States just doesn't work. In fact, what usually happens is that these companies are hopping from one country to the other. If wages get too high in one country, or if the local governments have the temerity to actually enforce their labor laws, they shift production to another country. So we've seen that shift, and we've seen it happen where more recently they're even shifting to Ethiopia, saying Bangladesh is too expensive. You know, Vietnam is too expensive, China is too expensive, for their shifting production to other countries. So a strategy that's just built on keeping jobs here, particularly in the garment sector, just doesn't work. And I think unions are recognizing that now, and have been for quite a few years. So yes, what we've been attempting to do for instance, in Bangladesh, the Rana Plaza disaster, in which more than 1,100 workers died when a building that held five factories, garment factories, collapsed. And that factory, or the building housing those factories, had been visited by social auditing firms from a number of companies, none of whom had noticed that there were cracks in the wall of the building that would result in it falling apart. So Canadian unions, for instance, a delegation of Canadian unions went to Bangladesh, visited the site of the Rana Plaza disaster, and came back and have been building solidarity with workers and worker support organizations in Bangladesh ever since that happened. So I think once people see firsthand what the consequences are of globalization in industries like the garment industry, they're quite prepared to build solidarity back home in their own unions for the struggles of those workers.
So often when people think about critiquing corporate practice within the garment sector, and the Maquila Solidarity Network obviously was, as you mentioned, focused first on the maquiladoras in the context of the North American Free Trade Agreement and supporting workers in that context. But the outsourcing of labor from corporations, subsidiary sort of systems, often I think, you know, especially even today with sort of like hashtag frameworks, it's often sort of directed towards people targeting a specific company. Whereas like the situation with outsourcing creates a complex web of responsibility. And so I'm just wondering if you could detail a bit more the importance of understanding that sort of system. I know that your work has focused on that in various ways and in various contexts globally over the years.
Yeah, well, I think what you have to, when you look at this particular industry, it's one where, and I think many people don't understand this yet, when you're talking about a factory producing in a place like Vietnam or China or any countries that are garment producing countries for the North American market, there isn't just one brand that's sourcing from one factory. It's multiple brands sourcing from the same factory or group of factories. So that you actually have a situation where if you target only one company, you're not really addressing the root causes of the problem. And I think one of the things we're moving towards is looking at situations where there are multiple companies, not just in one factory, but in one country, in multiple factories in one country. And I always fall back on this one of the Bangladesh Accord, because what that was there was basically an eruption happened throughout the industry when that building collapsed. And people realized that there were multiple brands using that same factory, including Loblaw in Canada. And the brand, the Loblaw Joe Fresh brand, was found in the rubble of the Rana Plaza building, which is what forced them to take action. But basically what we found was there were hundreds of companies, major brands and retailers who were using factories in the Rana Plaza building and other factories in Bangladesh, and they were shared facilities. And what we ended up with fighting for and gaining was an accord between trade unions and the brands and the retailers that was signed eventually by over 200 companies. And 200 companies had to be part of a program which was an independent inspection program for over 2,000 factories in Bangladesh. So we weren't just talking anymore about one brand in one factory and we target that one brand. We were talking about an entire industry and a problem that permeated through the entire industry. And how do we deal with it? What that did is go beyond private sector social auditing and actually establish a system and a program that was between trade union organizations and companies with an independent inspection program, with health and safety training for workers in those factories, with a complaints process with the workers. And the companies didn't investigate. It was an independent inspection program that did the investigations. So I think what's happening in our movement right now is we're moving beyond looking at individual corporate responsibility. We're moving towards things that are like legally binding agreements between groups of companies and trade union organizations. And we're a witness signatory for that particular one. And also for enforcement mechanisms that go beyond individual social auditors, private sector social auditors who go and visiting factories. So I think the shift, the fundamental shift that has happened is people are now looking at agreements that are legally binding on companies where they share liability, not just responsibility, but actually legal liability. And the other trend that's parallel to that is looking at government due diligence legislation that would hold companies accountable and open to court cases from the victims of what's occurring in their supply chains. Those two things are happening simultaneously. And I think so we're really moving beyond the voluntary and beyond just targeting one company or another company about a particular case. But we still have to deal with the cases because workers get fired every day for trying to organize a union. And we have been successful in many cases in getting those workers reinstated and allowing for unions to operate in those kind of plants.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, people might, and that's healthy, be skeptical about sort of like responses that involve corporations in terms of mitigating systemic abuses towards workers, like you're talking about the fallout from the Rana Plaza disaster. But so in that regard, I'm just wondering if you could speak about, you know, and Maquila Solidarity Network has been, you know, linked to social activist movements for many years now, decades, I believe. Mm-hmm. At least I've heard about your work for at least 15 years. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role that like all the social activism around like expressing solidarity with Rana Plaza workers, many who lost their lives, of course, plays, as well as the tangible specific follow-up that happened from labor union and solidarity organizations. Just if you could just highlight how like constant attention and focus actually can have results, essentially, is what I'm trying to look at.
Right. Well, I think one of the most successful things in the movement has been the activism of students and primarily university students on particular cases, but also on the creation of the Worker Rights Consortium. The Worker Rights Consortium is a US-based monitoring organization that's totally different from private sector social auditing organizations. And it's one that was created really in response to students against sweatshops. And this is also, I mean, everyone who is a university student or professor or somehow connected to universities knows that universities also have brands. They have sports teams. They have clothes, sports gear, all kinds of things that bear the university name or logo. And that means that universities have tremendous purchasing power that they can actually apply to companies that are their licensees. And so basically what we've seen is, you know, mobilizations of students on particular cases. One in particular was in Honduras, where there was a cancellation of orders by hundreds of universities in the US and Canada that then resulted in the establishment of an independent union in a factory.
And that's in response to students against sweatshops.
That's right. That was students against sweatshops in both the US and Canada at that time. It's not as strong in Canada as it once was, but it's still quite strong in the US. And the Worker Rights Consortium was created as a response to students against sweatshops work. Unlike other initiatives, unlike the Fair Labor Association, for instance, it's one where there are no companies on its board of directors, or it's not in any way beholden to companies. It's totally independent. It does far better inspections of factories, it publishes not only the information as to what violations were found, but it publishes updates, and they name the factory, they name the brands, and they publish information on exactly what corrective action has been taken, how progress is going, what is still to be done. So there's a tremendous amount of transparency in what they do. And they have, even though they're a very small organization, they have a lot of weight, and companies pay attention to what they say because they know they have the students behind them. And students can mobilize if companies refuse to take action.
So I guess the last question that I feel is really links a lot of what you've shared is the ways that thinking about like the globalization of industries in relation to the globalization of activism. So your organization, as you've mentioned, focused first on like thinking about workers and maquiladoras in the context of the North American Free Trade Agreement. But as you've outlined, you've addressed examples of systemic abuses of garment workers in Honduras, in Bangladesh. You've addressed briefly, of course, like reliance on garment workers in Vietnam. And now today it's more and more in Ethiopia. If you can think about and offer any reflections, it'd be appreciated about also how movements and activism and like networks of organization and labor unions also can respond on a global level, and thinking about things in that sort of transnational sense, why that's important.
Well, one of the things, maybe we should go back to Mexico, because since we were first involved, what's happened more recently is there's a new trade agreement, as you know, this between Mexico, the US, and Canada. And as part of that trade agreement, it has something that was never there before in any other trade agreement, which is that there's actually ability for in unions to provoke inspections of particular factories where workers' rights have been violated, and to even affect their ability to export the products from that factory across the border to the United States or to the Canadian market. So we now have, after years and years and years, networks that exist between trade union, independent trade union organizations in Mexico and trade union organizations in the US and Canada. And recently, there was a vote at a General Motors plant in Guanajuato state, in which workers voted to reject their existing collective bargaining agreement and are now trying to organize an independent union. And this was part of the reason that this was possible, which is very seldom possible in Mexico, is because the trade agreement in this case was used by unions in Mexico and Canada and the US to call out this violations of workers' rights that had taken place in that factory and establish an agreement between the Mexican government and the US government that actually meant that workers could vote on their collective bargaining agreement without any harassment. It was observed by the ILO. It was observed by the Mexican Electoral Commission. And the unions in Canada and the United States were watching it closely. So this didn't come about, you know, by accident. This is after years and years of relations being built and maintained between trade union organizations and labor rights organizations in the three countries. So that's totally different than what I remember when we first started out, when people often were saying and fearing that Mexican workers are stealing our jobs. This is in an auto plant, and it was Canadian auto worker unions and U.S. unions that supported the workers in this particular case. And the workers will end up with an independent union that can negotiate improvements in wages and working conditions. So that's a dramatic change from what we saw when we started.
Right on. Thanks so much for taking the time to speak today, Bob.
All right. Well, thank you, Stefan.
Thank you.
That was a conversation with Bob Jeffcott from the Maquila Solidarity Network, an organization I think that has done really important work to highlight the conditions of garment sector workers globally, looking at first the conditions in Mexico, in the Maquilas, but then internationally today, looking at the sort of systemic injustices around garment sector workers globally and the campaigns and efforts by groups like Students Against Sweatshops, which you heard about in this exchange, to that are drawing attention to the conditions of garment sector workers. Thank you, Bob Jeffcott, for joining Free City Radio. I am your host, Stefan Christoph. It is the 20th of September, and this is the 60th edition of Free City Radio. It's really a pleasure to share this weekly broadcast with you. I'm going to go out with a piece of music that a friend of mine, Nicolas Jarre, worked on as part of a soundtrack for a film that came out of Chile called Emma. And it's a great piece. I'll be back next Tuesday. Free City Radio shares a new podcast every Tuesday. If you like what you're hearing, please tell a friend. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts. This is really a project that is shared by word of mouth. So if you like what you're hearing, please let others know. I hope you have a good day and take it easy. I'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Sentido, ya no es amistad, ya tiene lo que sí, eso es la verdad. Ahora estoy en tu cárcel, y nunca más voy a amar. Estoy en tu destino, eso es más que verdad. Esto ya no tiene sentido, ya no es amistad, me tienes enloquecido.
McGill University's 4th annual Queer History Month is taking place this October. The featured keynote presentation is taking place from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on Friday, October 1st, with entomologist Jessica Ware of Rutgers University. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., and finally, a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawenodas Sedalio Fazio. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
Saturday, October 16th at The Ritz, Orchestra Criminal returns to the stage armed with their repertoire of ancient criminal tunes from Moldova, Morocco, Greece, Ukraine, Poland, Argentina, Afghanistan, Russia, and Mexico. Orchestra Criminal is a 10-piece of improv performers interpreting inspired renditions of adventurous gangster songs from a dangerous and forgotten era. Saturday, October 16th at The Ritz, Orchestra Criminal, with special guests Meduse. Tickets $15 in advance at bluesguysturnblack.com, $20 at the door. Doors at 6:30, a co-presentation of CKUT.
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test-COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X X